Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Dorothy Gundy, Katie Weaver, and Anna Mateo. Later, Katie Weaver and Ashley Thompson have a special report on one of America's national treasures. But first, this report. When students around the world think about higher education in the United States, a few images are likely to appear in their minds. They probably see beautiful old buildings, libraries full of books, and open grassy spaces where students relax or walk to class. A list of famous names probably comes to mind as well. Harvard University, Yale University, Stanford University. The list sometimes stops after just 5 or 6 schools. But there are over 4,000 colleges and universities in the U.S. Why do only a handful of them gain so much attention? One reason is history. Schools like Harvard and Yale have existed for hundreds of years, so people have been hearing about them for hundreds of years. Another reason is reputation. Some of the best-known schools, including Harvard and Yale, are part of a small group called the Ivy League. These private American colleges and universities have long been thought to be among the best in the world.
John Gaines says such schools earned their reputations. Gaines is the director of undergraduate admissions at Vanderbilt University, a private research university in Nashville, Tennessee. While not part of the Ivy League, Vanderbilt is widely seen as a top American school. Gaines says, for generations, schools like Vanderbilt have produced important leaders and thinkers. But he admits that these famous schools are far from the only places that offer an excellent education. The top schools in America are also extremely difficult to win admission to. For example, about 39,500 undergraduates applied for admission to Harvard for the 2017 school year. The university accepted just a little over 2,000. In 2016, Vanderbilt accepted fewer than 3,500 of the more than 32,000 students who applied. Gaines suggests every student should consider other possibilities in the face of such competition. He says they should look at schools with fewer international applicants or those seeking a more diverse student body. Gaines says applicants who are a little different than most can be especially appealing.
The truth of the matter is the very best-known places in the United States have admit rates that are really very small, he told VOA. We're hyper-selective in many ways. And so, the international applicant or the American who is broadening their search may, in some real way, be enhancing their chance for admission. Gaines says there are many sources for information on the different types of colleges and universities in the U.S. The U.S. News and World Report and the Princeton Review are some of the most popular sources of this sort of information. The two groups rank and review schools using many kinds of measures. But Gaines says students should make use of the U.S. Department of Education's College Scorecard. He also suggests the nonprofit organization The College Board's Big Future website. Both services are free, and they let students search for schools based on qualities like location, cost, size, and kind of programs offered. The College Scorecard even lists graduation rates and the average amount of money students make after they graduate.
Ryan Ricciardi says looking for information beyond just a ranking can be extremely useful for students. Ricciardi is an admission official at Bowdoin College in Brunswick, Maine. Bowdoin is a private college with about 1,800 total students. The school accepted about 14% of its applicants for 2017. School rankings are decided using information like average scores of common tests and size of investments. So Ricciardi argues that more detailed information that directly relates to a student's individual needs is much more useful. Rankings don't tell the full picture, she told VOA. They don't talk about the experience that students have. They don't talk about the research opportunities that are available. They don't talk about the work that professors are doing and publishing. They just give you data. And that data is really important and interesting. But it's just data. It's not the food that you're going to eat, the professor that's going to teach your class.
Ricciardi and Gaines both say that students should start their exploration by asking themselves several questions. Do they prefer small classes or big ones? Are close personal relationships with their professors important to them? Do they want to be in a small town or a big city? The answers will help them narrow the field of possibilities. Ricciardi also says that parents should also understand and accept that not everyone can or will get into a big-name university. But, she says, many successful people have received great educations from lesser-known schools. The CEOs of all of these companies, the chief researchers, the doctors that are saving lives, they didn't all go to the number one university, she said. They all got a lot out of their education, no matter where they went. It's how they invested in it as individuals and what they've gotten out of it that they're using to make the world a better place. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.
A new film tells the life story of the man who created the Wonder Woman comic book character. Angela Robinson directed Professor Marston and the Wonder Women. The public got its first look at the movie a few weeks ago at the Toronto International Film Festival. William Moulton Marston was a professor at Harvard University in the early part of the 20th century. He was also in love with two women at the same time, his wife, Elizabeth, and a student, Olive Byrne. She became his assistant and his lover. The three lived together as a family. Welsh actor Luke Evans plays Marston. He says he was surprised to find that the script was based on a true story.
This man was a Harvard professor of psychology in the 20s, went on to invent the lie detector test, or the early forms of the polygraph, what became the polygraph, then fell in love with not just his wife, but another woman who then shared their lives for the rest of his life, had a wonderful family, and then created Wonder Woman. The same person did all of those things, and it's an extraordinary, extraordinary story, one that most people have no knowledge or idea about, so it's about time it was made.
Australian actress Bella Heathcote plays Olive Byrne.
I mean, it's great to tell the origin story about this character who's a feminist icon, created by a feminist, based on these two women who he loved. And the message is all about empowerment and equality.
Robinson, who has directed several television shows, including True Blood, The L Word, and How to Get Away with Murder, says the movie is a love story.
There's this really amazing love story at the center of what Wonder Woman eventually came to be. So it was really exciting to kind of bring that to the screen and see where Wonder Woman kind of truly began.
William Marston died of skin cancer in 1947. But Elizabeth and Olive stayed together and raised the children they had with Marston. I'm Katie Weaver.
Now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. On this program, we talk about words and expressions that we use in everyday conversation. Today, we are going to talk about mysteries, and more importantly, how to solve them. So, what are the keys to solving a mystery? If you said clues, you are right. Clues are pieces of information that help you find an answer. The word clue has an origin story that may surprise both native English speakers and those learning English. The origin of the word combines a Greek myth, a labyrinth, danger, and knitting. That's right, knitting. But first, let's start with the myth. In this story, a monster called the Minotaur lived in a labyrinth on the island of Crete. From time to time, people were sent inside the labyrinth as sacrifices. They could not find their way out, and the Minotaur killed and ate them, except for one man. As the story goes, Theseus volunteered to go into the Minotaur's labyrinth. But before going in, Theseus unraveled a ball of yarn. He battled the Minotaur and killed it. Then he followed the yarn back to the opening of the labyrinth and came out alive. You may be saying to yourself, that's a great story, but what does it have to do with the word clue? Well, in the 1590s, a ball of yarn was called a clue, spelled C-L-E-W. Because of this Greek myth about Theseus, and possibly other stories too, the meaning of clue began to change. By the 1620s, the word meant something that will lead to a solution. After more time passed, the spelling changed to C-L-U-E, the way we spell it today. Clue continued to become even more widely used. By the late 1940s, someone who didn't have a clue meant someone who didn't understand something, Today, we commonly use this clue in many expressions. You can use it to talk about someone who doesn't know a specific thing or about someone who is generally ignorant. For example, I am organizing a surprise birthday party for my friend. She doesn't have a clue what I am planning. When the guests jump out of their hiding places and yell, "Surprise!" she will be shocked. That is a friendly use of the expression, but it can also be used in a more critical way. For example, I could say, "I have a friend who was born into a very rich family. I feel uncomfortable when she complains about people who struggle to pay their bills on time. She doesn't have a clue how hard it can be to make a living." Instead of "didn't have a clue," you could also say "she is clueless" for both of these examples. Here's another example of clueless, meaning a general state of ignorance. I can't believe the boss made his son our manager. That kid is so clueless. He has no idea how this company works. We're doomed. That's an insult. Now, if someone is clueless or doesn't have a clue in the sense that he or she is simply ignorant, you can tell them angrily to get a clue. This is like telling them to wake up or to get with it. You can also gently clue them in. This phrase means to let someone know the way something happens. We often use it when something is difficult to understand or see on the surface. So if you are simply sharing your homemade apple pie recipe with a friend, you probably wouldn't say, "I'll clue you in on how to make this apple pie." I mean, you could say that, but it sounds much too dramatic. But let's say a friend of yours moves into the apartment building where you live. Now, many strange and difficult people also live in that building. You might want to pull your friend aside and say, "Look, if you want to be happy here, let me clue you in on some of the characters who live here." Never talk directly to the guy who walks his turtle. If you need to say something to him, just say it to the turtle. And don't hang your laundry on your balcony. The woman living above you will shoot at your dry clothes with a water gun. And whatever you do, do not play classical music after 6 p.m. Your next-door neighbor was a conductor in an orchestra and misses it terribly. You will hear him crying for hours afterward. And that's all for this Words and Their Stories. I'm Anna Mateo.
Today, we visit a place of strange and silent beauty. As beautiful as this place is, its name provides evidence of very real danger. We are exploring Death Valley National Park. Death Valley is a land of beautiful yet dangerous extremes. It has nearly 1.4 million hectares of desert and mountains. There are mountains that reach more than 3,000 meters into the sky. The valley's Badwater Basin area is the lowest land in the Western Hemisphere. It lies 86 meters below sea level. Death Valley can be dangerously cold during the winter months. Storms in the mountains can cause sudden floods on the floor of the valley. But during summer months, the air temperature has been as high as 57 degrees Celsius. The extreme heat of Death Valley has killed people in the past. Death Valley does not forgive those who are not careful.
Within Death Valley National Park is evidence of several ancient volcanoes that caused huge explosions. Evidence of one of these explosions is called Yubihibi Crater. The explosion left a huge hole in the ground, almost a kilometer and a half wide. In many areas of Death Valley, it is easy to see where the ground has been pushed up violently by movement deep in the earth. This has created unusual and beautiful rock formations with colors of red, brown, gray, yellow, and black. In other parts of Death Valley, there are lines in the rock. The lines are evidence of the past presence of water. The area was deep under an ocean for many thousands of years. Much of Death Valley is flat and extremely dry. In fact, scientists believe it is the driest place in the United States. In some areas, the ground is nothing but salt. Nothing is able to grow in this salty ground.
However, it would be wrong to think that nothing lives in Death Valley. The valley is full of life. Wildflowers grow very quickly, even after a small amount of rain. Some desert plants can send their roots down more than 18 meters to reach water deep in the ground. Several kinds of birds live in Death Valley, as do mammals and reptiles. Visitors might see the dog-like animal called the coyote, or wild bighorn sheep, or other animals like the desert jackrabbit, the desert tortoise, and a large reptile called a chuckwalla. Many different snakes live there too. Some are dangerous, like the sidewinder rattlesnake. It is an extremely poisonous snake with long, sharp teeth, or fangs. Throughout history, Native Americans found ways to survive in Death Valley. Rock art and other remains show that humans lived in the valley as far back as 9,000 years ago.
Death Valley is a huge place. It extends more than 225 kilometers across the southern part of California into the neighboring state of Nevada. The valley is part of the Mojave Desert. The area got its name in 1849. That was the year after gold was discovered in California. Thousands of people from around the country traveled to the gold mining areas of the state. They were in a hurry to get there before other people did. Many people were not careful during their travels. One group trying to reach California decided to take a path called the Old Spanish Trail. By December, they had reached Death Valley. They did not have to survive the terrible heat of summer, but there was still an extreme lack of water. There were too few plants for their work animals to eat. The people could not find a pass through the tall mountains to the west of the valley. Slowly, they began to suffer from a lack of food. To survive, they killed their work animals for food and began to walk out of the valley. As they left, a woman in the group looked back and said, "Goodbye, Death Valley." The name has never been changed.
Death Valley officially became a national park in 1994. It is the largest national park in the lower 48 states. More than 1 million people visit the park each year. Titus Canyon is one of the most popular places to visit in the park. It has huge mountains, colorful rocks, ancient rock art, and rare plants. There is even a ghost town, a town that has been abandoned by all its residents. Death Valley is full of ghost towns. Many people visit Death Valley in late winter and early spring, when wildflowers come to life there. The harsh desert floor becomes very colorful.
Some visitors come to Death Valley for just a day. Tour buses bring travelers from Las Vegas, Nevada. They ride around the park in their bus, visit several places, and are back in their Las Vegas hotel by night. However, many other visitors stay in the park. The most popular area to stay in is Furnace Creek. Furnace Creek is the largest area of human activity within Death Valley National Park. There is a hotel as well as places to camp. The historic inn at Furnace Creek is a beautiful hotel that was built of stone nearly 90 years ago. The inn is built on a low hill. The main public room in the hotel has large windows that look far out over Death Valley. Hotel guests gather near these large windows in the evening to watch the sun make long shadows on the floor of the valley and on the far mountains. This beautiful image seems to change each minute. The sun slowly turns the valley a gold color that deepens to a soft brown, then changes to a dark red. As night comes, the mountains turn a dark purple color, then black. Usually, visitors are very quiet as they watch the setting sun. A few try to photograph it. But the valley is too huge to capture in a photo. Most visitors leave only with the memory of the fiery sunset in the extraordinary Death Valley National Park. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.